Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Theater Podcast. I'm your host, Alan Seals, and our guest today is Hunter Foster, who obviously comes from an incredibly talented family. He is an amazing performer in his own right, and of course, his sister Sutton has done many things as well. He's been off the stage as an actor for the last 6 years since he's become an in-demand director and has now decided to come back to the stage to originate an amazing role in the world premiere of The Griswolds' Broadway Vacation that looks just incredible. So, without further ado, find me online on Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast. I'm on TikTok at The Theater Podcast. Don't know what I'm doing, but I'm there. I'm still on Facebook, and please leave a rating and a review, and everybody please enjoy this episode with Hunter Foster. Today's guest is an actor, director, writer, and librettist with Broadway acting credits, including Little Shop of Horrors, which earned him a Tony Award nomination. You're in Town, The Producers, Footloose, Les Mis, and Grease. He was named 2018's Director of the Year by Wall Street Journal for his productions of 42nd Street at the Bucks County Playhouse and The Drowsy Chaperone at the Goodspeed Opera House. And he recently directed the critically acclaimed The Other Josh Cohen off-Broadway here in New York. And if that wasn't enough, he is the artistic director for the Red House Arts Center in Syracuse, New York, and, as we speak, is originating the role of Clark Griswold in The Griswolds' Broadway Vacation at the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle. Hunter Foster, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Man, you keep yourself busy between acting and directing. I guess we'll get into the childhood, how you got into it in the first place, but I want to start sort of in the middle where, asking, did you originally set out down this path to be a director or an actor, or did you just kind of fall into one or the other by accident?
No, I originally wanted to be a writer. That was like when I was younger. That was sort of my dream, was to be sort of a novelist. And then I sort of stumbled into acting when I was in high school and sort of loved it as an actor. And so that kind of went on for a while. And, you know, I was able to work a lot, which I'm very thankful for. And then I started got back into writing and started writing shows. And then there was a show that I wrote called Summer 42, which was an off-Broadway musical that was done back in 2001. And Jed Bernstein, who runs the Bucks County Playhouse, is like, I want to produce Summer 42. And Lonnie Price was supposed to direct it. And then Lonnie dropped out because he was doing the Merrily We Roll Along documentary, and which is a fantastic documentary, by the way. And so then Lonnie's like, you should direct it. I'm like, I've never directed anything in my life. But then I was like, I'll give it a shot. And so that was my first, I sort of stumbled into it. And, that's sort of how it happened. You know, I was, and then I just started doing more and more as people keep asking me to direct stuff. And I was like, oh, and then before I knew it, I became a full-time director. Like it was, and the acting stuff sort of, I didn't have time to do the acting stuff. So, because I was having so many projects in the future. So I sort of took a hiatus from performing for probably about, I don't know, I started directing in 2014, and I did a few things here and there acting-wise, but I've been mostly a director for the past 8 years. So, and again, I stumbled onto it. I never thought of myself as doing it. And then I realized, you know, I had learned so much from working from, like, you know, Jerry Zaks and Susan Stroman and, you know, Kathleen Marshall and James O'Pine, all these like greats who I'd all worked with. And you kind of like, oh yeah, I know how this works. I've seen these great people do this for years. So, yeah.
Wow. That so happened. So doing Clark Griswold now, is this the first time you've been back on stage as an actor in how many years?
6 years.
Wow. 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 So was it, I mean, are you approaching the role as an actor much differently, like the creation of the role? Are you approaching it differently now that you've got now 6 years plus of directing under your belt? Like, you understand sort of what a director is looking for in somebody originating a role?
Absolutely. I tell people, I even said this to Kate Rockwell, who plays Ellen in the show, or she's on maternity leave right now, but she asked me the same question. I said, yes, absolutely. I said, if you ever have a chance to do it, I said, you see it from a whole different perspective. So like you change the camera lens to out front, and then now that I'm in it, I'm like, oh, this is, I just have an idea of what people are seeing out front, if that makes any sense. I'm like, I should do this here, or I should be on this spot, or I should. So I kind of like, and I don't want to say self-direct, but just I know where I should be in space, or I know how I should deliver lines, or know things because I've seen it happen. You know, I've directed probably 80 productions by this point, and you know, I just have a now stuff that I never knew before. I know now. Like, I know how, I just have a lot more, my much better instinct, much, much better instincts on stage than I ever did before.
That's super cool. So do you think that this is sort of a foray back into performing more, or is this just a little blip in the director? Like, you had time to do this out of town run here, and you didn't come back and continue to just direct like crazy, or do you want to like sort of start splitting your time?
You know, I never saw myself sort of like retiring from acting for good. My first love, I think, now has become directing. I just love, I love the creative process, and I love, you know, working with actors, and I love teaching, and I love in colleges, and I just, that part of me is, I think, will always now be the first thing that I want to do. But this was a perfect project that I, when it came along, you know, I was a big fan of those movies when I was a kid, and my mother was a big fan of that, of the family, and it reminds me so much of my own family growing up, and so I just felt like it was something I really wanted to do, and we'll see how, you know, I mean, this is just the beginning of the journey for us, so we'll see how far it goes. But I have like 3 or 4 directing projects that are lined up after this, so I'm definitely going back into directing. You know, we'll see. It's good to know that, you know, there's 2 avenues here, because like I said, I love being a part of the theater, and any way I can be a part of the theater is, you know, I'm thankful to be a part of the theater in any capacity. But I think my first love is directing, and I definitely want to get back into that once this journey is concluded, or who, I mean, like I said, we don't know where this journey is going to lead us right now.
That's really cool, because I want to back up now a little bit, because you said you originally wanted to be a novelist, like not a Broadway writer, but like a book writer. And so we'll get into that in a second. But I think it's very cool. I just want to comment on the fact that you wanted to be a writer, then found theater and acting, and through that have now found what you're just calling your true love, right? Which is directing and teaching. So I want to call out for those listening that you never know where accepting opportunities and these chance encounters are going to take you, because you've gone from wanting to be a book author to being a in-demand director. And I think that says a lot to who you are as a person, and just accepting chances and accepting opportunities when they come your way. But backing up to the novelist stuff. So as a kid, right? Like, what did you want to write? Were you like horror, sci-fi? Why writing as a kid? I know so few kids who are like, I love to write, because they're like, I just want to play video games.
I've always been interested in storytelling, and stories, writing stories, telling stories. I think that's part of, you know, theater is telling stories. So even as a director, I tell the cast, I mean, we're telling the story. We have to tell the same story. We have to tell the story together. We have to tell the story in the same way. That's basically what we're doing, you know. So I think my love of storytelling, I think, is where it all sort of begins, and where we sort of are right now And even as an actor, you know, when we have discussions about the Griswolds, I'm like, okay, what is the story we're trying to tell as this musical, even as an actor, like, what story am I telling? I'm a big fiction reader, and I was like that when I was a kid. I was definitely more into sort of sci-fi and horror and things like that, but you know, I was just really inspired by, I think when I was younger, it was more sort of coming of age stories. But I was definitely, into sort of, I mean, post-apocalyptic, you know, all that sort of like, but kids, when you're a kid, you think of like the world has collapsed and how do you, you know, Walking Dead type stuff or, I really wanted to, and I hope that, you know, I write stuff. I started writing musicals, the books musicals, because that's what I knew. And, I've written 5 or 6 of them. And those are so much harder because you're collaborating with a composer. And there's so many things that go into that. And as a book writer, as a novelist, you're the scenic set designer. You're the costume designer. You're the sound designer, you're the director, the choreographer, the actors, like you are everything, which I think is, I don't know, that's something kind of neat about creating the world, that it all comes from your head. And you can also, there are no, I think the limits to what you write in a book, there are certain limits to certain things you can do on stage, in a musical, and as a novelist, there's no limits. You can create whatever you want, and it's not going to blow the budget. You know, you know what I mean? You just, it's limitless. The imagination, the book, the scope of a book can be as big as your imagination. And
would you ever want to go back? Would you ever want to go back and start like writing? I mean, I guess maybe did this happen in COVID? Did you have any downtime where you were just like, you know what? I'm going to try to write my end of the world apocalyptic take on, you know, coming out of my brain. Right. So have you put forth any books like, or have any drafts or ideas?
Yeah. I started writing something, and then I didn't really have the pandemic off, like most people. I was I'm no longer the artistic director for the theater in Syracuse, but I was an artistic director during the pandemic, and so that ate up just about all of my time. So even though I was in Syracuse, and we were sort of like, my wife and I were like huddled in our apartment. I was on Zoom meetings like constantly trying to figure out, because we didn't know if the theater was going to survive and we didn't know what we were doing. So my whole pandemic time was really, really busy trying to figure out how to save the theater. So I didn't have time to do that. But I did start, I have an idea that it's been kind of, in the works for a while. So I'm hoping to finish it once, but then the Griswolds came up, and that's basically taken almost all of my time right now. So, but yes, I will. You know, before I die, I'm going to finish. I'm going to do it.
Well, that's a good goal. That's a good goal. I feel like one thing is going to lead to another, and you'll end up being commissioned to write something anyway. Just given the circles that you're in now, and how well you do accept new opportunities. But I think it's very cool, and I wonder if this was intentional in your involvement with Griswold's Broadway Vacation. Book, music, and lyrics written by David Rossmer and Steve Rosen, who you directed them. They also wrote books, lyric, and music for the other Josh Cohen. So I guess the other Josh Cohen was phenomenal, by the way. I saw it. It was amazing. And it deserved all the awards that it got. Very critically acclaimed. So first off, how did you get connected with the two of them for Josh Cohen? And then was it just a stars alignment where you're working with them now again in this show?
I've known David and Steve for a long time. I've directed Steve, I think in, maybe 5 shows, I think total. And so we've known each other for a long time. Steve knows my wife and has worked together with her. And so I know David through them, and we did a Josh Cohen at Jiva in Rochester, the Jiva Theater Center, And that's how I sort of got connected, because my wife and I have a connection with Jeeva, because my wife's from Rochester, and Mark Cuddy, who's the artistic director, I think, was like, I think Hunter should direct that Josh Cohen. And so, I met with the guys, and so we did it, and we did it up at Jeeva, and then they asked me to do it off-Broadway, and then we did it off-Broadway. I think it was, you kind of want to work with people that you know and are friends with. You know, I think that there's something that's really, I mean, I do, I like to work with people that I know and get along with. And then, you know, they, when they were sort of funny, I was out in Aspen, I was directing a show in Aspen, and they kind of called me last minute, and they said, you know, we're looking, we need someone to play Clark in this upcoming workshop. And I don't know if maybe they'd had someone else who was involved. I have no idea. Couldn't do it, or they couldn't find someone. And they called me and said, would you come in and just sort of do Clark? And I thought, oh, I'll just do this because they need someone. So I just said, I didn't think, this is going to lead to something else or whatever. I was just like, if you guys, I'll just, and so I did their workshop, and then they started talking about maybe me doing it for real. And I was like, well, do I want to do this for real? I mean, because I had directing projects lined up all through the summer. And then it started getting more and more real. And I was like, oh, is this something that I want to do? Okay. And then it sort of happened. Then I had to sort of work around all the stuff I had planned. But it went from being like we need someone fast because for whatever reason, and I thought it was just like, I thought it was going to be just a stopgap, and it ended up being like me and being in the show. So that's the way it happens. Crazy. That's what you do. You call your friends up and you say like, hey, I need someone to come in and do this. And that's what I thought it was. I'm like, sure, I'll come and fill in.
And then lo and behold, look, a month later,
I know.
Clark Griswold.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
You said you have experience like watching the movies, and this is family, that, you know, the character of Clark and the family is this archetype that's existed in our culture for a really long time. So I'm trying to figure out in my own mind if that would make being in your shoes easier or harder, because is there already preconceived notions that you're coming in with, or are you starting fresh like any other unknown character, but then with the added complexity that you've got all this director experience now, like you said, I just don't know which lens you're approaching this under. It seems really complicated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's what's really different about our version is that, you know, other sort of movies that are turned into musicals are basically you're taking the movie and it's the same story, you know. So like Beetlejuice is the movie, but it's musicalized, right? Even though Beetlejuice was great in the how it was put together and constructed and made it theatrical, but this is a completely different story. Like, this is just taking the family that we know and giving them a completely new thing. So people are coming in, we're not seeing Christmas Vacation, you're not seeing Vegas, you're not seeing European, you're seeing a brand new, which I think is really interesting and very different from how other musicals, sort of movie term musicals that you see. And, you know, I think there is a, The most popular one is Christmas, obviously, because Christmas it comes around every year, so everyone watches it. So when I ask young people, they're like, they don't know the original one, but they know the Christmas one. So they know the family from that, right? And, you know, there is definitely a Chevy Chase, it's Chevy Chase-isms that are sort of baked into Clark Griswold, and you have to pay homage to that. And so, you know, I've been watching those movies for such a long time. They're just certain things that are. And I'm, of course, I would never say that I'm Chevy Chase, but because he's an amazing comedian. But there are certain things that are just kind of that Chevy Chase and Clark Griswold sort of like are to get, you know, there's his mannerisms are in Clark Griswold. So then it's also trying to find, so I pay homage to that. But then I also have to bring my own, like my wife tells me all the time, she goes, you are Clark Griswold in life. And I'm like, so then there's my own, I bring a little bit of my own sort of. And I don't want to just, you know, my own self to it as well. So it's been kind of trying to pay homage to what the original source material, finding something in myself that is Clark Griswold and sort of creating its own new kind of thing, as opposed to trying to, you know, recreate, you know, Chevy Chase or what those characters are. I think we're trying to sort of make it its own thing, especially in this new brand new story. And I think, like I said before about being a director, all those things are in how I think and plan. And, you know, I think when I was younger as an actor, I just sort of like went off instincts, you know, and now I really sort of think in the same way that I plan directing. I really sort of think about how to do this part and where I am on stage and plan sort of the bits and things that I do because, and it's just made me better. It's made me much better knowing that I was a director. Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of fun, and especially originating a comedy with somebody like Kate, who has incredible comedy chops of her own and the rest of the cast, right? Is it just an incredible playtime? I think Patti LuPone was saying that, like, her whole philosophy is you learn your lines, you learn all the basics before you ever start rehearsal, so that when you come to rehearsal, it's nothing but experimenting and playing, right? So is that the same for you? And are you working with Kate Rockwell and the others and just saying, like, how about we try this? And then what wouldn't it be funny? Or, like, let's adjust the timing here. You know, when it comes to comedy is so specific to make it good, to make it mm-hmm. seem like it's off the cuff, you know? So what's that whole process like? For you in general?
Well, you know, comedy's hard to... Yes, I have certain rhythms and beats in my head because I think comedy is also music, you know, it has to be... It's a timing, but it's also... There's a musicality to comedy and how you say your lines. And you really don't know how comedy works until you get in front of an audience because... there's a rehearsal room thing, you know, rehearsal room laughs. You've heard that sort of for years. Like, can't go on rehearsal room laughs because in rehearsal we're laughing at the actor, and you're not laughing at the character because we've been rehearsing together. So you're looking at the actor, and if the actor does something funny, then you're like, oh, Hunter did something funny. But we have to know that the audience doesn't know me personally. They're only looking at the character. So you really don't know what's funny until you get in front of an audience. So the first, I always say as a director, is the first couple of days of doing it for an audience are like as a fact-finding mission. It's like going out and finding where the audience is reacting because you have to have a relationship with the audience. And so you have to go off their timing and what they're going to give you. And as Nancy Opal always says, it's like sort of like surfing. It's like going with the waves and going with them. And once you can find that sort of balance with the audience, then that's when things really, really can, and especially with a comedy, it becomes magic. And I learned that when I was in Producers and You're in Town. And, you know, it's just really sort of riding the wave of an audience. So it takes a while. You know, Bart Scher always says it takes 90 days for an actor to really lock into a character. So we'll only do like a total of like 20 some performances here. So it's not a lot to really lock in, but we're changing every single day. So like I learned, even we had an, you know, opening night last night. So you learn how that crowd, you know, reacted. And then you also have to, your timing in your head. So if the audience is not quite going to give you what you want, it means you got to go quicker. you know, or, and if they're going to give you a lot, then you got to hold back a little bit. So you just, you have to be in the role, but you have to sort of be intellectually thinking the whole time, because you have to, it's, if you can time it right, then you can get bigger reactions. We got a double laugh last night. That's something we've been working on. There's a bit in the show. And I just said, I said, if we just hold for a second, I think we'll get another wave. So the thing happened, got a big laugh, and we just held, and the audience laughed again and then started applauding. So there's things like that that you, you know, and you learn those things for over the years, right? You do it so many times, you're like, okay, this is how we can hold an audience. And but you got to be careful, because once you sort of take that leap, sometimes it doesn't always work. But we took that leap last night, and it definitely worked. So yeah, and that's the fun part about it, because you can, like, drama is easy because you can just tap in your emotions and whatever. But comedy has got to be, you know, if drama is cooking, and comedy is baking, you know how baking has to be precise or comes out wrong. Cooking, you can sort of like throw.
Literally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you do not do baking, if you watch Great British Baking Show, or, you know, whatever,
I do, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you don't measure and do everything correctly, if in cooking you can, like, throw in some, you can just keep doing it to taste, that's drama, and then comedy's baking. It's got to be precise, or it doesn't work.
I totally agree with that, because you can bake, two people can bake the same thing, and it could be really good for somebody, and the other person makes it fall flat and taste horrible, and you just don't like it. It's all about the delivery and trial and error. I love to hear from these professional comedians, or even go to their small off the wall shows that aren't publicized, because when they're trying out new material, it's even, you know, people that you know to be, like, always, I put in air quotes, funny, that they have to still do trial and error to find their own timing and find jokes that work and don't in different. And then you've got, like, different cultures and different types and ages of people that you're performing to, depending on where you are. Like, it's such this matrix of complication that I think just speaks to, like, the people who we do know as the best, how talented you actually are, because you're able to pull together all these little things and put it together in this perfect little rehearsed package that makes it seem not rehearsed at all. It's brilliant.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a great podcast. I think it's This American Life, and there's a reporter who traveled with George Burns, and right towards when he was in his 80s, and he was still doing comedy. And she talked about that. She said that he's George Burns, like one of the great comedians, you know, best old school comedians. And she said they would try stuff. He and his partner, who was like his producer, sort of comic, and they would write stuff. Then they'd go do it at night. And then they'd come. Then as soon as they get off the stage, they would just talk about what went wrong, blah, 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 blah. And then they would change it for the next. He said they would, even in his 80s, even a man who had accomplished all these things, and he was still working. And she said that what was amazing about him is that even in his 80s, he would come out and it felt like he was saying the jokes for the first time. And she goes, even though he rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and tried to make it, and it was all planned. He said it sounded like it was, that it had never been said before. So.
Well, yeah, it's hard. It is really hard. And that was sort of going to be, I guess, lead into my next question was, like, when you're doing comedy, everyone has a personal life. You have good days and bad days, and some are worse and better than others. And when you've had just, like, the crappiest day, is it easy or hard for you to separate that and turn it into the comedy? Because in my mind, sometimes when I've done the roles like this in the past, I get a little cynicism. Like, there's a little more edge to the delivery of the comedic lines, which, depending on the role, either kills it or amplifies it. And of course, you can learn from that. But are you able to kind of compartmentalize like that?
You know, the drama, doing stuff that are non-comedic is much easier, because I feel like, you know, emotions, whether it's, you can tap into strong emotions. If you had, you know, emotions from the day, like frustrations or anger or even euphoria, like there's that stuff you can funnel that into drama. I think that with comedy, I'd sort of, you know, because there was, even this past week, we had so many rewrites and we were changing so many things. So you know, my mind was just like mush trying to, I'd come into rehearsal and you'd come into doing the show thinking like, how can I be funny? I've got so much going on in my brain, you know? But you know, you just have to relax and sort of just go with it and just kind of give over. I don't know if that makes any sense. You just kind of like can't, I don't want to hold on to anything that's like, bringing me down or frustrating or whatever, you know, you just kind of like the show starts and you just kind of like you gotta do it. And, you know, I said it to one of the young people in our show, cause they're like, cause they asked me some questions and if you were frustrated in the afternoon, how do you break not? And I said, you just got to break on, you got to break through it. And I said, you got to get to the other side of it. I can dwell in it and sit in the I'm frustrated right now because I've been handed, you know, new lyrics and new lines. And I said, or I can just push through and say, I'm going to get to the other side of it and just do this and enjoy it and not let it get to me. Or like, and again, there could be things that are non-related to the show. It could be things in your personal life or whatever. And you just got to push through it. You just got to, it's your job. I always remind myself that this is your job. This is what I'm being paid to do. So just like any job, you got to come in and do it. And you can't allow your personal feelings to get in the way of that. You have to come and do your job. So yeah. And that's always a good reminder for me. It's like, this is your job.
Well, I guess podcasting aside, but most people's jobs don't have their performance reviews aren't public in the New York Times or, or other newspaper outlets. It seems like that adds an added level of stress and public scrutiny that a lot of people don't realize is kind of a big deal. But I want to touch on the family life for a minute too, because you were a writer, found acting. Obviously, your sister Sutton, like the two of you found acting, right? So like, were your parents, when you were a young kid, were your parents, encouraging you to pursue writing, or how did the actual finding, the discovery of acting happen?
You know, it's weird. My parents were non-theatrical at all. They didn't know anything about theater. People have always said, oh, you must have had show tunes playing in the house growing up. Sutton and I knew nothing about theater. We knew nothing about musicals. I wrote a play when I was in the third grade that I directed and starred in and had rehearsals for it. So there was, I don't know where that came from. and it was I was in third grade. It was 4 pages long. It was about Dracula. But I wrote it, I had a rehearsal, I directed it, and I was starred in it. And so I sit there, like that to me, I always go back to third grade, I said, that's where all that started. But I don't know where it came from. And then, like I said, my sister was not interested at all in theater. We were not theater kids. I think my mother was like, I was trying to find things for me to do for the summer. And I think she signed me up for some acting classes at the rec center. And I was like, okay, I'll go. And so I remember I was like the only boy. It was like me, I was 13 or 12. It was me and like 12 girls. And I was, first of all, I was like, oh my, I'm the only boy in here. And I just had so much fun. Like there was, you know, back then you were doing like, you know, be a giraffe and be an elephant and, you know, sort of game, it was all games and stuff. So I loved it. And then one of the teachers was like, you should try out for this play. And so I tried out for the play and I had so much fun. It was all just sort of like fun. It was like either playing sports or, you know, just like a kid does it. But I never thought that was going to be anything like that. And then, you know, and same thing with my sister. She wasn't interested in doing it until I started doing it. And then she's like, oh, this sounds fun. And then she started to do Christmas Carol every year. Like she was a Cratchit kid every Christmas. And then someone heard her sing and said, oh, you should audition for Annie at the community theater. And so she auditioned for Annie and got Annie. And then that's when she was like, oh, I really, really like this. And same thing for me. And then I started auditioning it. I was like, well, maybe I'll audition for the high school musical. And again, it was for Bobby Birdie. And I didn't know what Bobby Birdie was and didn't know what the characters, I knew nothing. And I got Conrad Birdie when I was like in high school. And I was like, oh. And so it's sort of like, I had so much fun doing it, and it was so different from, you know, playing sports, which I loved. I loved playing baseball. And I loved all those things. But there was something about the theater that was just, I really, and same thing for Sutton. And again, we sort of, that it sort of just happened. Like, I can't, and then I was like, well, I want to do more. I want to do more and more. And then everyone kept saying, well, you know, you'll grow out of it.
Nope.
You'll grow out of it. And then I went to school. You know, there was an up-and-coming musical theater program that had just started at the University of Michigan. I'm being dead serious. And they were, I remember there was a friend of mine, and she said, you should audition for Michigan. And I was like, okay. And so I auditioned. They were like begging men to come, they couldn't find enough people to come to that school at that time. And when I tell people that story, they're like, what? Do you know how hard it is to get in that school now?
Yeah, it's impossible now.
Yeah, Gavin Creel and I both believe neither one of us would have been taken. We both wouldn't have gotten in. I don't know about Gavin. I mean, me early on, it was literally just anyone. We need anyone. So, and so I went to that school. I went to Michigan, and then, I decided after, and, you know, my parents were like, oh, you're not going to do this. And I packed up my car and I drove to New York and just started auditioning. So, you know, there was never any other choice to it. So, you know.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that you just put one opportunity in front of the next and didn't look back. It sounds like there was never second guessing or anything. Did you have any of that, or was it in the moment you're just like, all right, here I am. Here, where's my next step?
I was so naive. I mean, I think I came to New York with $2,000 and my car, and I worked, I temped and scraped by, ate McDonald's every day because all I could afford, and stood in line at the Equity Building. The old ways of auditioning, you know. Now the Michigan kids come out and, you know, they got their Equity cards, they got agents, they got Broadway shows, and you know, back then there was nothing. There was no, you graduated from Michigan and you were like, good luck. So, you know, and I came to New York. You know, I remember coming to New York and there were 8 Broadway shows running at that time. There was 2 plays and 6 musicals, and that was it.
Wow. There's,
you know, 30 some theaters, and there were only 8 shows running it. So it was very bleak back then, as opposed to now, you know, with so many shows in the works and coming in, blah, blah, blah. But I was just naive. I was like, oh, of course I'm going to be in a Broadway show. Like, I never had any, and even when I would tell people that, they're like, you know how hard this is, right? And I was just naive. Like, and I think that's why I had confidence, because I was just completely naive about the whole thing.
Yeah. If you knew how hard it was.
Yes, I wouldn't have done it.
Wouldn't have done it. There's so many people have said that. Yeah. And it's the same thing. I think if you find joy in something, if you find happiness, and you, for that moment, you're passionate about it, just keep following it. Keep following that passion, because then how many decades later you're looking back and you're like, yeah, I never thought about doing anything else, because, like, you chase the passion. You follow it.
And it also can lead you somewhere else. Like, I have a lot of friends from college that, you know, one of my good friends from Michigan, we graduated the same year. He was a performer. He's now a big Broadway producer, and he does all the merchandising. He's doing all the merchandising for Griswold's Family Vacation and Broadway Vacation. So his path led him to the theater, but now he's a producer. So, or Rachel Hoffman, who is a musical theater student at Michigan, now she's a casting director. Or, you know, it leads you. We had a big Zoom meeting of our class during the pandemic, and it was amazing to, and like, I think me and like one other person, the only people left who are still performing, and everyone though was a success in something. Like, they all were like, one's like a dean of a college, and one is like, you know, a doctor, and this and that, and they all said, we wouldn't be where we are if we hadn't been in theater and gone through the program. It led us to all these other different things. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's what theater can, maybe not lead you to be a performer, but it led them to be successes in other things, because maybe it opened up their mind creatively. It allowed them to be a bit more fearless. I don't know, but it definitely helped propel them to where they are now.
We're gonna take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
There are so many things in life that stress me out. You know what shouldn't stress me out? Eating. So we can all eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options for all dietary needs. And you can discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and even some drinks to help you stay fueled up. Factor is also celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month's Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Say that five times fast. Earth Month Eats. Earth Month Eats. Just remember, these no fuss, no mess meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning up. So just simply heat and eat the good stuff. Head to factormeals.com/TTP50 and use code TTP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code TTP50 at factormeals.com/TTP50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up your springtime goals.
I think that's beautiful. And it's, I think there's scientific biology behind this. And I've had this theory since talking with Anthony Veneziale from Freestyle Love Supreme, right? And he worked with a doctor to get an fMRI machine while freestyling and while reading, just, you know, reading something that's already pre-written. And I'm trying to remember the name of the body part, the duolateral prefrontal cortex, I believe is what it's called. But there is a center in your brain that is responsible for inhibiting anxiety. And so that's why improv helps corporate events, and because you're removing your inhibition, you're helping yourself become more comfortable. And I think if we were to do studies on theater people who have gone on to other things, we'll find that they've got a predisposition because of theater training to be more open, more receptive to things happening wrong in the moment, right? So you've got all of these little characteristics that make somebody a good performer that you can apply to so many other professions, especially like being a doctor. Like, how many things don't go according to plan being a doctor, and you got to roll with it,
right?
And the show must go on, right?
Right.
Metaphorically, that's speaking, right. in doctor words.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, I think there's a lot of truth behind that, a lot of biological truth. Anyway, so let's wrap up. Now that I've gone on that tangent, with three closing questions I ask everybody on the podcast. The first one, just very simply, is what motivates you?
What motivates me is telling good stories, you know, and it's not just the stories we tell, but how we tell them. And because, you know, there's a lot of stories that are told over and over and over again, but it's, you know, I always say, people talk about Hamilton, I go, I said, if the bare bones of Hamilton is a story we've heard thousands of times.
Yeah.
But it's how Lynn told it is what makes it special. And I think that's what motivates me. I get excited when there's a new story to tell and there's a new way to tell it. You know, that's what I don't know if that's the correct answer to that question, but getting up every morning and saying, okay, what story do I want to tell today? You know?
Yeah.
Because that's what we pass on. That's what lives on. You know, you think about the stories that, whether it's Shakespeare or Camelot or King Arthur, all those things, Star Wars, Harry Potter, those things that will last forever. They go on forever. And so stories never die, and characters that live out there never die. So that's what motivates, getting up and telling new stories.
All right. What advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
You know, I think the most important thing is just to be nice to one another and kind. It's a very tough business, and we're constantly met with rejection and constantly being criticized and constantly being held under the microscope, reviewed, and, you know, kindness to me is the most important thing, because even as a director, when I work with people who I know are kind to each other, kind to themselves, that that's the kind of people I want to have in the room, kind of people I want to work with. We have an incredibly, our cast right now of Griswold's Broadway Vacation is an incredible bunch of people. Some of the most loving, respectful, kind individuals I've ever been around. And, you know, and that includes being kind to yourself. I think we beat ourselves up way too much. You know, we kick ourselves, oh, I didn't do this in this audition, or I didn't get this part, blah, 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 and now I'm worthless, whatever. And someone told me one time, they said, you know, don't be afraid of your own greatness. And I always think about that quote. And it's not being arrogant or being, it's just saying like, you have things about you that are great, and embrace those things and know that, and as opposed to shying away from that. Because a lot of times we're like, well, I don't know, imposter syndrome, whatever. Mm-hmm. No, don't be afraid of your own greatness. And we all have some greatness in us.
We all do. And I love that. The imposter syndrome is real. And if you're in the room, embrace it, because everybody else feels the same way. You know? All right. So the final question is the hardest one. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Once.
Ooh. Why?
Once to me is the perfect story. First of all, it's the, you know, one of the best scores I've ever heard. And it's just the simplicity of the storytelling and the simplicity of the relationship between the two of them that is so raw and, you know, simple and pure, and it's just a beautifully told story, and it gets me, you know, I had a chance to direct it, I've seen it, saw it on Broadway, and it's a wonderful story that I could watch and listen to over and over and over again. I love those two characters, I love their relationship, I love the love between them that they never come together. I love the sense of family. Like, there's something about those musicians playing together. There's a sense of community and a sense of family, which I love. And there's a real love of their culture, the Irish culture. And I just, it's just a beautiful story, and I can watch it over and over and over again.
Beautiful. No, not beautiful. Once. Different show. So, where can we find you online?
Online? Oh.
Yeah. On the socials.
Oh my God, I'm so bad at this. Instagram, Hunter_Foster is my Instagram. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, let me make
Facebook,
sure that's what it
TikTok,
is.
TikTok, Bebo.
Oh, I am on TikTok, but I don't know.
Are you?
I know I'm going to sound like old man Foster here. But no, Instagram, Hunter_Foster, Hunter line down Foster. And what am I on Twitter? I don't know. I don't know, this.
Probably the same.
What is it? Hunter_Foster. So at Hunter_Foster on Twitter and at Hunter_Foster on Instagram and TikTok, which we have some really funny videos, Jen and I, because we drove cross country when we came out here. What am I on here too? I think I'm, it's easy. I'm at Hunter_Foster8665. News. I don't know why that is. So Hunter_Foster at Instagram, Hunter_Foster on Twitter, and Hunter_Foster8665 on TikTok.
All right. Oh, coughing fit. I still have a little bit of COVID in me that I'm getting out. Oh, that's not fun. I am at thetheaterpodcast.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast. We got the underscore brothers. I'm on TikTok at thetheaterpodcast. Leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening now. The Jukebox Ghost gave us the intro and outro music, and Hunter Foster gave us the lovely conversation. Thank you, Hunter.
Thank you so much.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SuffsMusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.